This is the Meridian Podcast. On Thursday, the 24th of February 2022, Russian forces began their invasion of Ukraine. Whilst they expected things to be over in a matter of days and weeks, the war has now entered its ninth month. The lives of ordinary Ukrainians have been turned upside down, with nearly 8 million fleeing to neighbouring countries such as Poland and Romania, whilst there's been over 17,000 civilian casualties. But the Ukrainian army have put up a strong fight, with successful counter-offensives in the Kharkiv and Kherson regions pushing the Russians back further. But with a long and cold winter approaching, what comes next for both armies? Today on the Meridian Podcast, we're joined by retired Lieutenant General of the US Army, Mark Hertling, to discuss. Welcome to the Meridian Podcast.
Today, I'm really excited to be joined by retired US Army Lieutenant General Mark Hertling. He served for 37 years in the US Army, retiring in 2013 as the Commanding General of the United States Army Europe and the 7th Army. He is also a military analyst for CNN. General Hertling, thank you so much for joining us today. It's really exciting to get to talk to you about this incredibly important issue of the war in Ukraine. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Amelia, for having me.
So going into this war, Russia seemed to think that it would be over in a few days to weeks, and we're now in the ninth month of the war. For the listeners' benefit, could you sort of briefly set the scene on how much of Ukraine Russia actually occupy at the moment, and then any sort of counteroffensives Ukraine seem to be pushing at the moment?
Yeah, it's very interesting from the standpoint of your question, Russia coming in thinking they could quickly take all of Ukraine, but especially a fast movement in the eastern part. They have not done that. And that primarily is because of a disconnect between the strategic leadership understanding the capabilities of his military and how they plan this out. So having said all that, what has Russia achieved? From a percentage standpoint, I'm not exactly sure, but I would say there are still Russian forces on between 20 to 25% of Ukraine's territory right now. It's interesting because I sometimes push back on anyone when I work sometimes with CNN who says Russia controls X location or controls this oblast. Because truthfully, I'm not sure they control anything. They have forces in different locations in the Donbas region, Donetsk and Luhansk. They have forces in the southeastern provinces, but they are all being contested not only by the Ukrainian military, but I would also give a great deal of credit to the Ukrainian territorial defense forces. The so-called insurgents or resistance or whatever you want to call them, but it is the population of Ukraine along with their army that is fighting back and preventing Russia from establishing control over certain areas.
Yeah, and it was so interesting to see with obviously Putin's annexation of the areas and then several weeks later to watch the troops actually then withdraw from Kherson and to see the reporting from there was incredible. And I just want to drop on something you spoke about was the sort of disorganization of the Russian troops. Now, I'm sure you'll definitely have seen the things circulating on social media with the rusty weapons, soldiers in retreat. So what is the sort of state of the Russian army at this point?
Well, it's interesting because I had the opportunity on several occasions when I was still in uniform to visit Russian military bases, to have engagements with Russian troops. And in fact, in one case, have a major exercise when I was commanding in Germany where the Russians celebrated with the American forces. Now, again, this is in 2012, but there was an exercise we called Torgau, Exercise Torgau 2012. Torgau was the place on the Elbe River where in 1944, Russian and American troops linked up after they defeated the Germans. So there was a celebratory exercise we conducted every year. during that exercise, truthfully, I mean, as a commander and as a trainer, you're always looking for indicators of your forces' capabilities. As I watched the Russians train and exercise, they were, you know, I've called it in the past a demonstrative force. And what I mean by that is they can do drills which are very rote and directive and don't account for what happens when the enemy has an effect or when yeah. something in the weather affects you poorly. And this was 10 years ago. During that period of time, there have been, and even though I haven't been privy to it since I left the military, but intelligence sources have indicated a much further decline mm-hmm. of the Russian military from a logistics acquisition and training perspective. And it's all due to inside grift, corruption, high-ranking officials taking money away from programs, treating the soldiers terribly. So when you have that lack of trust, when you have the lack of capability of equipment to do as it's performed, and mm-hmm. when you have such a disconnect between your doctrinal tenets, what the books say you should do versus what you can do, mm-hmm. it spells defeat. And I saw that 10 years ago when I was commanding in Europe in the Russian army and through intelligence. It's further declined. At the same time, I've seen the growth in professionalism, leadership, approaches toward modern combat of the Ukrainian army. So from the very beginning, what I saw, truthfully, Amelia, was a mismatch between these forces. Even though mm-hmm. Russia claimed to be the fourth largest army in the world, it was shallow. It was a ghost army. So Ukraine has improved significantly. And I think we're seeing the effects of that in month 9, as you said earlier.
No, absolutely. I think Ukraine seemed to absolutely surprise everybody. Because like you said, Russia going with these claims about being the fourth largest army in the world, and Ukrainians are very much holding their own.
I'm going to push back, and when you said, I'm going to push back a little bit when you said it surprised everybody. It didn't surprise
maybe
me.
Not everyone.
And all of, by the way, it didn't surprise American, British, Canadian, French forces.
Yeah.
That trained with Italian, I'll include the Italians too, that trained with the Ukrainians in a place called Yavoriv and at other places where NATO exercises took place, because they really have the Ukrainian. I think this is an important comment to make too. Ukrainians have a very unique culture, a very close-knit patriotism, very different from their Russian counterparts as well. They were part of the Soviet Union, but in doing what I often had to do in drinking for my country, along with Ukrainian military personnel, they would explain to me how their portion of the old Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact was very different. And we truthfully, we see that in other countries too, like Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Romania, where they were under the thumb of the Russians for a very long time, but they are a very different culture with a very unique history.
Yeah, and there definitely has been, it's been amazing to see the determination of everyday Ukrainians, and they just have this incredible, you know, ability to keep going no matter what the circumstances. But there has been some concern, hasn't there, with the Russian attacks on infrastructure and how the Ukrainians might deal with the lack of light and the lack of heating. I was watching a report on CNN recently, and that was a woman who said she had on average half an hour of power a day. So do you think that with that, do you think it'll affect the morale enough to do any damage, or do you think the Ukrainians will be able to keep pushing through the winter?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think we're on a seesaw on this. There certainly is the potential for it to affect the will, grit, determination of the Ukrainian people, but we haven't seen that yet. It's fascinating how resilient they have proven themselves to be with a lack of heat, energy, lights, power. And, you know, when we think of those words, we think about, you know, the lights in our rooms and the heat in our houses. But the implications for medical facilities, for emergency services, for security, all of those things, sometimes we don't even consider. You know, if someone has an accident and breaks a leg, how do the doctors or a brain surgeon? I saw a piece the other night that was just fascinating with neurosurgeons on the front line conducting operations on soldiers in a very dimly lit room with, you know, the flashlights on their head.
Yeah, the head torches.
Yeah. And it's just, it's amazing. I don't know how to account for that. I know we're at the very early stages of winter in Ukraine, and it's going to get much colder.
Yes.
But it appears to me, God bless them for this, that they have proven themselves to be beyond resilient, saying there are more important things than heat and electricity this time. Our freedom and our sovereignty is much more important. And I sure hope that President Zelensky can continue that innovative approach to leadership that has his people saying, we're going to stand firm against this.
No, absolutely. I think the other thing.
Amelia, if I can, I'm sorry for interrupting, but Americans have not experienced this. But if you, as a Brit, talk to grandparents during the Blitz of World War II, there was the same kind of resilience in Europe. And more so than what we're seeing even in Ukraine right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember speaking to my great granny who used to sort out the pieces of engines after plane crashes. And she would talk about finding, you know, stickers and things. And they just got on with it because she knew that there was something bigger than what she was going through. It was a very amazing conversation to have with her, but
there's that great British poster that almost appears to be a meme nowadays, but it's stay calm and carry on. Well, that's exactly what the Ukrainian people are doing. So
definitely
people in your school and in places throughout your country can certainly understand this, or at least have a history of it more so than we do in the United States.
I think as well, possibly the thing that's concerning a lot of people in the West, especially Europe, is the oil and gas situation here. So, and obviously NATO at the moment has maintained this very united stance. They're very much in support of Ukraine. But heading into the winter, and I see it here in England with the sort of the heating costs, and people are choosing between heating their homes and putting food on the table, because of the gas cutoffs. Do you think it's possible that the united front of NATO could start to slip with the sort of cold winter heading into Europe?
That truthfully, two things concern me about this conflict. Number one, the unity that you just talked about. Will we be able to maintain this in the West with an understanding that what Ukraine is fighting for is really for all of us as well? Yep. It's the sovereignty of national territory and the freedom of individual people. The other thing that concerns me truthfully is the rebuilding of Ukraine when all of this is over. That doesn't get to your issue on gas and fuel oil, but it does tell me that you know, what we're seeing is somewhat of an inflection point in Europe. Europe will never be the same after this. This is like the United States after 9/11. You know, you go through airports now and it's all different and security is very different. European energy security will never be the same because Russia will continue, in my view, will continue to be a pariah on the world stage for decades to come unless they radically change their approach to working with their neighbors. So I think this is just the start of that. And it's a conversation that I know is part of the dialogue at NATO right now between different countries. So I don't really know how to answer that question. I think we're seeing some turmoil on the world's oil market.
Yeah.
And I don't know how. I'm not a, you know, I'm a soldier. I'm not an economics major. So I certainly don't know how all that is going to pan out. Yeah. But it's going to be interesting to watch, isn't it?
Yeah, well, hopefully NATO will be able to sort of keep this united front despite everything going on, because it is vital to the success of Ukraine.
Yeah, you know, if I can say one more thing about this, mm-hmm. the commander in Europe, you know, I would get intelligence feeds every day. Mm-hmm. One of the areas of interest I would have on a daily basis were the so-called frozen conflicts of Transnistria, Nagorno-Karabakh, Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Georgia, and the Donbass.
Yes.
What concerns me is not connected to the weather today, but the potential for a frozen conflict in Ukraine that could go on years and years and years. Yes. And that to me is unacceptable for the Ukrainians, but it should also be unacceptable for the West. But it seems to be what's been in the Russian playbook in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems as they seem to think if they can drag it out, almost there'll be disengagement from other countries and they'll be able to sort of sneak their version of victory that way.
Right.
Then on the other hand, Putin almost seems sort of backed into a corner at this point. You know, the army really isn't doing very well. The partial mobilization in Russia really didn't go down well. Do you think, and he also said the other day, he was talking about the threat of nuclear war rising and refused to rule out the Russian use of a first strike.
Right.
So do you think that could possibly occur? Do you think he could take that step towards a nuclear war if he feels trapped?
Yeah, it's interesting because my gut tells me no. Mr. Putin has been using the threat of nuclear escalations since long before the start of this. He tried to deter, and he continues to use it. But while my gut tells me no, from a political or a military perspective, you always have to be concerned about it. You can't say that's not going to happen, because then it becomes a gamble as opposed to a risk. Mm-hmm. You can mitigate risk. You can't mitigate a gamble if you mm-hmm. choose wrong. Will he do it? I think not. But at the same time, everything I've thought about Mr. Putin has been wrong so far in terms of him doing dumb things. So would he do another dumb thing? Potentially. And you have to always consider that as part of the mm-hmm. equation.
Yeah. So preparation rather than concern on that ground. Yes, it does seem he is doing more and more unpredictable things as of late, doesn't it?
Right, exactly.
And in regards to the West's continuation helping Ukraine, what, from a sort of military perspective, can they send that is going to help the most? Because I was watching the report the other night where the Ukrainians have been asking for the cluster munitions that Russia have been using. Now they've been asking for them from the US.
I will tell a quick story, and I'm sorry if I bore your listeners, but I am one of the few people alive today that has suffered the effects of cluster munitions in the U.S. Army. During Desert Storm, there was a, which I was a young major at the time. I was in a unit that was hit with 5 rounds of cluster munitions, and I still carry shrapnel from one of those munitions in my leg. It is horrific in war. It is a devastating weapon in war. But what the United States and Britain did in Desert Storm was, I think, I'm not sure I have the numbers correctly, but we dropped over a couple of 100,000 rounds of cluster munitions from either artillery or aircraft or rockets. They were aimed always at military targets. In the case where I got hit, it was a fratricide incident. It came from one of our own guns. But the danger and the reason 100 countries have signed up to ban cluster munitions is because of the danger it poses to civilians. The Russians have not proven to care about that.
Yes.
Providing cluster munitions to the Ukrainians, in my opinion, and I'm not a policymaker, so my opinion doesn't count, but in my opinion, would be a mistake because there will be civilian casualties if they fire these munitions into territories where soldiers are fighting, because there are, we're on a battlefield today that has a lot of civilians on the battlefield. Yes. So I would be radically against, even though I understand the Ukraine army's desire to have these munitions, because mm-hmm. it can certainly destroy people in trenches and artillery rounds and all that. It can counter artillery. The benefits are not outweighed by the unfortunate aspects of the munitions. Going back to your question, though, what is next for the Ukrainian army? The Ukrainian army is a good army.
Yes.
It's not a great army. The difference between good and great is the ability to conduct combined arms operations at a large scale. What I mean by that, where infantry, artillery, armor, engineers, intelligence, signals, logistics are all synchronized for a fight to regain territory. The Ukrainians have a modicum of that capability, but they're not really good at it. And I don't mean to denigrate the Ukrainian army. I think they would concur with my assessment on that. Yeah. So what happens next is, I think we're beginning to see, and it was first reported in Great Britain, where the British forces were training Ukrainian forces, not just individuals, but large-scale forces. I think we're going to see more of that in the coming months at places like, and I'll name some places, Grafenwöhr, Germany, Drosko-Pomorsky in Poland, Sinku in Romania, where the training centers that have been doing very well at training states' armies in those different countries will reach out to the Ukrainians and train them for the capability of combined arms operations. Mm-hmm. When that occurs and those new forces get on the battlefield, they will far outclass the Russian military and will be able to retake ground very quickly. There's a habit in the United States right now, and I'm sure it's the same in your country, where we want to give Ukraine everything.
Yes. Yeah.
Give them TACMs, give them Patriot missiles, give them, you know, Leopard tanks, give them Gepards, you know. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that it's a society that doesn't understand how militaries and armies work, where they come together and synchronize their effects. Mm-hmm. So just giving a nation something that takes a long time to train on, is hard to repair and maintain on in the field, and should be synchronized with other forces, in my view, is not the solution. Even mm-hmm. though I want Ukraine to have that capability, I also know, as a former military commander and trainer, it takes a long time to get there. So that's a long, I'm sorry for that long answer to your short question.
No.
But it gets to the point of what comes next, the ability of the Ukrainian army to train better and to support combined arms operation to take over the last vestiges of the swaths of territory that Russia still exists on.
Yeah, absolutely. The training, it's all well and good to send arms, but the training is really necessary to make the whole thing come together. And also, thank you for sharing your personal there as well. It was really incredible to hear. Thank you. Yeah. Also, talking about the US and Russia, obviously Brittany Griner was released yesterday from Russian custody. President Biden had said in the past he wasn't particularly talking to President Putin and wouldn't have spoken to him unless there was anything to do with Griner or Paul Whelan on the table. And then suddenly there's the breaking news that Griner has been released. So do you think that's possibly a sign of hope that channels of communication between the two countries are more of a one-off, long negotiated scenario?
No, I don't see it as a new signal of improved communication. I see it as a one-off,
of
getting an American of many that are in countries around the world back. As I know you know, there is a huge debate going on between our different political bodies about should we have done this and given up Victor Boot. I personally, and this is a personal opinion, I think the answer is yes, that we should have done this. I don't know what went on in the communication and the engagement between the two countries to make this happen. But I do know that for a president to trade an arms dealer for a basketball player is a very difficult decision, but it has to do with getting back, getting your citizens back and getting them freed. So it was a decision and a call that was probably much tougher than any I've ever made in my life, the president made. I applaud him for it. It's unfortunate that he wasn't also able to get Paul Whelan back as part of the package. But I think I'll trade a criminal for a human being anytime.
No, absolutely. I've just got one more question for you just before we wrap things up. It's obviously impossible to make predictions regarding the war in Ukraine. I don't want to ask you to sort of predict the future, but from your point of view, how does this conflict end? Does it sort of drag out and then end with Vladimir Putin, or is there something the Ukrainians can do that'll sort of speed things up? So how does the whole thing end, do you think?
Yeah, it's a question that's repeatedly asked by a lot of people, and I don't know. But there are a bunch of options. One option would be the Ukrainian forces regain or gain such a capability that they could literally defeat the Russians on the battlefield and regain their territory. That's one. And that's the one I hope for. Number two would be we're seeing indications of increased protest and counter-Putin actions in Russia itself. But that's a hard thing to see what may happen as well. If Putin is deposed and if there's some type of coup, then the question becomes, does Russia trend toward a more modern state with an attempt to get back on the world stage, or do they just appoint another Putin-like character? And that's, you know, no one can predict that. All we do know, students of history know, that every time Russia has had a revolution, it has not turned out well afterwards.
Yep.
So, you know, we can look back in history and see that. The third option would be a negotiation. I'm loath to think that that might be the approach, because I'm concerned that it might harm Ukraine's sovereignty and what they fought for so far. And even with a negotiation, you're still going to have, if Putin is still in charge, a border issue where you have a very you have one country that's got an expansionist approach toward foreign affairs, and you have another country that wants to live in freedom, bumped up against each other. And we've certainly seen that in throughout history as well, and that never turns out well either. So I don't know, Amelia, how it's going to turn out.
Yeah.
But, you know, truthfully, I'm hoping and praying every day that it turns out for the better for the Ukrainian forces and their people, because they are, my time in that country has shown me what a beautiful culture and what we just had a concert here in Florida down in Orlando with a group of from the Ukrainian orchestra. Symphony.
Oh, amazing.
And the culture is just, I mean, it's just, it's marvelous. It is just, and they have the potential, truthfully, I think in the next decade or so, along with a few other countries like Poland and Romania, to being the new leads of the European Union, which I'm going to predict right here on your show, that we will see a transfer of power base within Europe within the next decade, from the West more toward the Eastern part of Europe. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, you heard it here first on the Meridian podcast. That's what's going to happen. And
pay no attention to that old retired soldier. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, we will certainly keep an eye on that. And in 10 years or so time, we'll have you back and see if that has... General Mark Hertling, thank you so, so much for talking to me today. It has been amazing to get your perspective. And thank you for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Amelia. And best wishes to all of you in cold and wet Britain right now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Meridian Podcast. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed creating it. If you liked what you heard, why not subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, so our latest episode lands in your feed. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok too, at The Meridian Podcast. And if you've got an idea for an episode or would like to appear, send us an email at meridianpodcast@gmail.com. This episode was presented and edited by Michael Gorham and Amelia Hardy. The theme music is Impending Uncertainty by Gavin Luke and Solar Flare, licensed by Creative Commons. Until next time, thanks for listening.